we want to outthink things. We want to think that there's these programs and systems and curriculums. It's love and literacy. If we just start with that, we have a foundation of greatness.
Coming up on In Contrast, Teaching Children Entrepreneurship and Finance with Ty Allen Jackson. Ty Allen Jackson is an author, publisher, and businessman. In 2009, Jackson's son wanted to start a lemonade stand, a request that ultimately led to writing and publishing Danny Dollar Millionaire, The Lemonade Escapade, and launching Big Head Books with a mission of creating books about children of color and promoting literacy. Ty Allen Jackson, is a pleasure to have you on the show. Let me start with a very general question. We live at an age where reading in general seems to be in decline, not only among children. Books matter less and less. Why focus on this particular aspect of our society now?
It's more than just children's books. It's so much about literacy. Literacy is so connected to most of the things that develop us into the people that we are today. It's that emphasis on making our children realize that reading, in my opinion, next to love, is the most important thing that you can not just instill but give. It's that premise that has really kind of pushed me and my organization to inspire children to read and expand their mind and their imagination. I firmly believe that literacy and reading, it's the most powerful and most wonderful and most organic of forms of communication and entertainment, and it just needs to be enhanced and nurtured.
What happens when we don't read? What is the landscape when we don't have books?
There are several statistics, and one of them, the one I'm about to state, is the one that really changed my philosophy regarding me being a children's book author and developing more into a literacy advocate. And that statistic is that 2 out of 3 children who cannot read proficiently by the 4th grade will end up incarcerated or on welfare. And whenever I read that, wherever I see that, whenever I say that, I literally get goosebumps to think that if we are not empowering our children, statistics, not my opinion, state that our children are more than likely to do drugs, they're more than likely to commit crimes, they're more than likely to become pregnant as a teen, they're more than likely to drop out of school. The majority of the things that ail our country, and these are just teenagers, these things also, of course, trickle down to when they become adults. It's essential to empower our children immediately with the love and the compassion and the nurturing of reading, not even just when they're born, but even when they're in the womb. It really is essential. When you don't read, you don't succeed. It really is as simple as that.
Succeeding in reading is often said to be either the achievement or the defeat of teachers, of schools. But you and I know well that it starts even earlier than that. It starts in the home where books, where the act and art of reading need to be essential. For children to read, adults need to read. How do we create an atmosphere in which adults will understand and will want to engage with reading so that their kids have the path that you're describing?
James Baldwin, the poet, has one of my favorite quotes, and I have to paraphrase, that children have a hard time listening to adults, but they never fail to emulate them. And that's remarkably true. The parents need to realize that they are their, and will always be, their primary teacher. So it is essential for them to be the role models that they need for their children, and they have to develop and nurture that love of reading and that culture of reading in their home. It must be as paramount as dinner at the kitchen table. It really is remarkably important. So the question of how we engage our parents and sadly, I think it's anything else. I think it's fear. I think fear is a great motivator. And when we state to them that your child has a better chance of becoming a statistic if you do not engage with them in reading, sadly, I think could be one of those forms. And it's unfortunate that we may have to go in that direction, but that's one of the many forms. I think one of the other forms is kind of the opposite. It just has to be fun. And reading, to me, has always been a level of fun and entertainment, and it has been since I was a child. When my mother would take us to myself and my younger brother, and we'd go to the library and pick out a bunch of books, and we'd bring them home and go on her bed, which seemed like a throne when you're, 4 or 5 years old, your parents' bed seems like a throne. And she would spread the books out across the bed, and we'd take turns reading and acting out and being silly. And it was in part those things and things like that that really engaged me to become the reader that I am and eventually the writer that I am. But I think it's that great balance of educating parents and saying, this is what can happen if you don't read, but also with a great balance of saying, this is the amazing amount of fun and engagement and love that you can when you do.
We also know that we, as passionate readers or authors or parents or teachers that are committed to reading, are also competing against all sorts of other forms of storytelling, storytelling that comes through television shows and the internet and the movies. So it's not so much the absence of storytelling, because without storytelling, we would not be who we are. Storytelling is like breathing. But it is the competition of, if you get the story somewhere else, why the fear of getting it in books?
There's something organically that happens to us in our soul when we read. When you see on the television or on the movie screen the blades of grass that you're walking on, as opposed to reading about the softness of the blades or how they sway in the wind, it changes everything, how you feel about that same blade of grass that you just saw and took for granted, as opposed to it being directed and navigated in such a way that you can actually feel the blades of grass on you, as opposed to seeing them for yourself. So reading helps enhance, more than anything, I believe, our imagination and expands our thought process and helps us develop our minds and our strengths socially, spiritually, academically. Reading is so much more than just picking up a book. It really is an instrument for the soul.
You are a literacy advocate. You're also a children's book author. You were bringing me back to that moment when you and your brother would be read or would find books in the throne that was your mother's bed. I wonder if you can walk me through the transition between being a reader and becoming a writer. At what point did you say, I can do this? I can be on the other side of the page. I can be the one that provides the stories.
I have to say that I had zero intentions of ever being an author in any capacity. And it wasn't until 40 when I got this epiphany. The story is simple. 10 years ago, I was in corporate sales and had a very good job, 3 kids, white house, picket fence, you know, the whole nine. And I could have been very content in that job, probably for the rest of my life, making pretty decent money. But it wasn't my purpose. It wasn't why I was here. In fact, at 40, I honestly didn't know what that purpose was. And then my son asked me a question. And this question completely changed my life. And the question was very simple. He said, Dad, can we open up a lemonade stand? And I'm originally from the Bronx, born and raised. And the one thing you never see in the Bronx is a lemonade stand. They just don't exist. But I live now in Western Massachusetts, and lemonade stands are commonplace. So I said, sure, son. And we got a cardboard box with the tablecloth and a pitcher of lemonade and a little umbrellas. You always have to have the little umbrellas. And in 3 hours, this cute little six-year-old kid made $50 selling lemonade, which completely blew my mind, because I'm thinking we're just going to make $5-6, you know, go get some ice cream, call it a day. But then he says, Dad, what am I going to do with $50? The big, smart parental answer was, I don't know. And I really didn't. What do you tell a kid to do with $50? You know you don't want him to spend it all on video games and bubblegum. So I took my son to the bookstore. There should be books about finance and entrepreneurship. After all, my son was now an entrepreneur. So I go to the bookstore, and there are thousands of books, obviously, and I couldn't find one book about money, not one children's book about money. It baffled me. What baffled me even more is when I saw the lack of diversity within the children's books that I was looking at. And I guess I never paid attention to it before. I have 3 kids, and I read to them all the time. I don't know why I never put together that there just wasn't a great representation of diversity within the world of literature. So I took those two components of no books for financial literacy and no books featuring children of color, and I went back to my car and I realized that I need to do something about this. And as I said that out loud, the name Danny Dollar just popped into my head. And I started right in the car in Barnes & Noble's in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in their parking lot, writing this story about a young boy named Danny Dollar. And I sat there for about a good hour before I realized I was still writing this story. So I went home and I just started typing. I've never written a book before. I believed in this, and I worked on it for a good year, learning how to write, which I had never done really before, not in this form. And in about a year to a year and a half, I was done with this manuscript, and I was so unbelievably proud of it. So much so that I said, I'm going to take this to the next level, and I started contacting agents. And I went to every single state and contacted literary agents from every place, and I actually contacted 147 different agents across the country and was rejected by every single one.
And what was the gist of their responses in those rejections?
Most of them were saying, we have a book similar to this. And I would ask them, well, what is that book? And they wouldn't come up with the title, or just didn't fit our demographic. It just seemed to be the commonplace. We're just not interested, some people would say. I saw two things. One is that only 3% of all submissions to agents actually gets published. I'm actually surprised it's that high. But that also 93% of all children's books published only feature Caucasian characters. So I had a lot of strikes going against me having this little boy of Danny Dollar who just happened to be a child of color, who just happened to be black. I figured I got two choices. One, I could print out this manuscript and put it on the wall and think about what might have been, or I could learn to do it myself. And I did. And it took about a good year to learn how to publish a book, along with myself and my wife, Martique Jackson. About a year after that, the book came out for the first time. And it was one of the most powerful moments of my life because it made me realize that even though I was a knucklehead kid from the Bronx with a single mom who was only 15 years old, never walked on a college campus till I took my daughter to college for the first time, that I could do anything it is that I wanted to. And the next month, I reached out to Carver Bank in New York City, and they are the largest black-owned bank in the country. I sent a copy to the CEO saying, I think this would be an amazing book for you to teach the children in your community about finance and entrepreneurship. And 2 weeks later, she called me and said, we would love for you to come here and talk to the children in our community about finance and entrepreneurship through this book, and we'd like to buy 1,000 copies. And I quit my job that day.
Let me go deeper into that story in different directions.
Sure.
This is a country that is built on the concept that you are going to be successful if you have money, and that you can make your own money no matter where you come from. The American dream is about the possibility that all of us will have access to that opportunity. And yet you are saying, and it's absolutely true, there is an absolute absence of books that talk directly about making money and about children of color in particular making money. What makes us uncomfortable about all this?
That is such a great and powerful question. I kind of wish I had the answer. I read this book recently by a woman named Jen Sincero, and it's called How to Be a Bad ASS. I don't know if I could say that. She gave this great analogy. She said, if money was a person, it would be so disenfranchised to have a relationship with you. Our relationship with money is so poor. We want it badly. We do almost anything for it, but when we get it, we feel guilty about it. Sometimes if we have too much of it, we feel insecure. When we don't have enough of it, we thirst for it. We treat money really poorly. I think like anything else, perhaps it's about exposure and education. And most people don't know that money is a tool. And like any tool, you need to learn how it works. And most of us aren't introduced to it that way. It's money is a thing to spend. It is not a tool to build. And until we take a more conscious effort to learn how to use money as that tool to build a better life for ourselves, I think we're always going to have that perception of money just being a bad thing, the root of all evil, yeah. Which is absolutely positively ridiculous. Imagine, again, if money was a person and you looked at that person and said, you are the root of all evil, how would that person treat you? Yeah. It would get as far away from you as humanly possible. I think that's one of the reasons why so many of us don't have it, because we treat it absolutely poorly.
Do you think that there is also a difference between how we approach money gender-wise, men thinking of money and women thinking of money?
From almost the beginning, people are conditioned that women are to make less than men, and they do so in almost every capacity, whether it's in the boardroom or in front of the silver screen, that they always seem to make less. And it really is absolutely shameful. There's no way I could dive into the logistics on how and why that is. I will say I've always believed that women are the smarter and stronger sex, and especially when it comes to money. So we need to learn to treat them a little bit better, and certainly not even more as equals. I consider them to be superiors.
Do you think that there is a lack of education, not only in children's books, but in our schools, where teaching about money should be not about something that is we were using the word dirty or evil, but something organic, something that is approached in a frontal, direct, open way?
I 100% believe that. And I also 100% believe that that will never happen. I can certainly get on my soapbox and discuss things about race and classism, but we need classes in this country. This country is built on an upper and a lower class. And for that reason, especially in public schools, I sincerely believe that money will never be taught, because then you are giving those who are less and disenfranchised the opportunity to learn on how to grow and how to develop, in which then you start to eliminate that lower class. I know it's conspiracy theory-esque, but I do believe that it is not a coincidence that in the majority of public schools, financial literacy is not taught. Yet it is the most organic and basic thing that we all need to know. There isn't a person in this country that at some point or time are going to need some level of financial literacy to become a thriving adult. Yet it's the one thing that we don't generally teach in public schools. Again, I sincerely believe that can't be a coincidence.
We are also a society that is free-spirited and entrepreneurial and inventive. And there is often someone who will attach herself or himself to a new idea and venture a revolution. Why have we not? The country is old. Why are we so slow? Is it because really we have to keep the status quo the way it is, or because we are also blocked mentally in different ways?
I think it's a lot of all of the above. We've seemed to have grown in every capacity, from technology, transportation, agriculture. We advance in every single aspect of society. Yet teaching has the same principles that it has basically 60, 70 years ago. I'm not exactly sure why that's the case. I do believe that we need to overhaul this educational system. I don't know what the answer is, and I certainly don't want to try to offend or tell teachers how it is that they need to do their job. I just know that we've been pretty much doing the exact same almost assembly line job for decades, and the results speak for themselves. We are 24th in literacy in the world. And how can you be a superpower? How can you be and hold yourself as the greatest country when your citizens, millions of them, are functionally illiterate, and you are 24th in the world in literacy?
So when we talk about literacy for children and literacy for children of color, I couldn't agree with you more. I am thrilled to be listening to you and exploring these ideas. Though I want to go again a little farther. One thing is to wish this, and the other one is to implement strategies that will create a literacy that will make sense, that is not cruel and crude, but that is functional. So what are your ideas on how to engage children of color with how to save money, how to make money, how to go out and create new things that make money for them? In what way should we create a literacy for children of color that is for them as part of society? And in what way should we create a literacy for them that is for them alone?
Let's go with the first part, is that, first of all, I don't write books for children of color. My characters just happen to be children of color. If you pick up any of one of my four books, you would see that there is never any reference to them being a person of color or for them to have any stereotypical types of characteristics. They just happen to be books that feature children with just stories that are broad and diverse, for lack of a better word, and inspiring. I sincerely believe that you can take my main character, Danny Dollar, and replace him with a little Asian girl and change it to Danielle Dollar, and you wouldn't have to change anything except from the him to her. And that was important for me. I want children to be able to look at books as a source of inspiration, as a source of entertainment, as a source of fun. And that's kind of what's missing, especially in diverse literature. The majority of books that do feature children of color, any color, they're usually historical or cultural in nature. And you do two things when authors do that. One, you isolate only that demographic. If I'm a Latina and I'm writing a book for Latina children, well, then why is the little Asian girl going to read that? Why is the Hindu boy going to read that book? That book's not for them. For the Black girl, that book's not for them. But what you also do is that you don't expand the mind of the person that you are trying to reach. So you really isolate yourself in a tremendous way. When you're an author of color trying to write a book featuring a specific demographic, it's really wrong. You're doing a disservice, especially if it's a great book. If it's a great book about, little Asian child, well, then why would I pick that up? That book doesn't speak to me or my child. So we have to be more broad-minded and write books that are just for the general population of our children, to inspire each and every one of them. And I think we have to make them more fun and engaging, and not so much with the heaviness and the burden of whatever our cultures are, our history, or how we overcame and all those things. When we were at the bookstore at Barnes & Noble, we were looking at some books, and I think there was a book about Jackie Robinson and Muhammad Ali, as I was trying to find books featuring Black characters for him. And he said, Dad, why do I have to read about Muhammad Ali? My friends don't read about Babe Ruth. And I thought that that was really profound, that he understood that the majority of the books that he reads, they feature characters that don't look like him, and they're not about their history. They're not about, you know, their cultural background. They're just great stories that kids enjoy and love reading. So I think it's really paramount that we not take the heaviness of what our society has put on the shoulders of cultures, and for children, give them some escapism. Give them something to make them laugh, to make them love, to make them feel good about themselves. And I think the moment that you start tackling history and cultural awareness, and I'm not saying those things aren't important, I think they're remarkably important. The problem is when that's the majority of it, then I think that you're walking a very dangerous line.
I empathize very much with what you're saying, and I can, at the same time, playing the devil's advocate, think from the point of view of children's books editors that you don't publish books for any child or every child. You publish books for particular children. Often our children have already experienced a series of alienating, xenophobic, racist elements before they open the book at 6 or 7, unfortunate as that might sound, and they have become Latinos or created in their mind this idea that they are the color of their skin or the religion that they have. What you are suggesting is a beautifully, maybe even utopian view. I love it. Utopia means there is no such place, though, in Latin. And so I wonder if it's important also to be conscious that when we're publishing books for children of color, that it is to empower them.
There should be books about empowerment. What I'm stating is that that shouldn't be all of it. And just because there isn't a utopia doesn't mean that we can't create one. I believe that there should be a wonderful assortment of books for children just to be able to read it for themselves. When you're 3 or 4 years old, you don't want to know about the Underground Railroad. You want to know why the bunny is running down the hole. And I think that we have to have just more of that. We have just more wonderful stories that unites us and stops separating us and stops putting us in these little boxes. Again, when you write the book for the little Asian girl, that's just her world. That's where she is and that's where she stays. When you have a universal character who travels the world, then you travel the world with them. And you don't travel it as a little Asian girl. You travel it as an explorer, as a wanderer. And that's what we need more emphasis on. We need more wanderers and less demographics.
Do you think that in 50 years or in 100 years, we are going to look back at this moment in American history and say, look at the books that they were publishing at that time, how impoverishing, how limited? What do you think the Library of Future Children's Books is going to be 50 years from now?
That is such a great question. Well, in addition to the context, there'll be the way that we actually read. And there are so many people that don't embrace technology as e-readers or iPads or whatever the case are. And I think we absolutely need to embrace them as a form of entertainment. First of all, technology is not going anywhere. And we can't force our children to walk into a bookstore and smell the wonderful smells that we smell. That's our life and that's what we grew up with. But that's not what our children are growing up with today. They're growing up with these devices that are in their hands that are just limitless means of opportunities. And we have to compete with them. So if that means that we have to download a book on their phone or their e-reader to get them to read, I'm okay with that. I'm better than okay with that. The objective is to read, not the device in which they read. 50 years from now, what will our libraries be like? There is something special about walking through those doors. There really is something beautiful about seeing these walls of magic in these cases. So I hope that they absolutely do still exist, but maybe they'll exist differently. You know, little iPads that you take out or books that you press a button and you can download it onto your phone. Many libraries do that now where you can download a book on your iPad for the same 2 weeks that you would to take out a traditional book. And after 2 weeks, you have to renew it. And after 2 more weeks, it's gone. You have to give it back. And I think that's wonderful. That's exactly where we have to adapt because everything else is evolving. So we just have to learn to evolve with it.
Do you like the concept children of color?
I'm comfortable with it, and I'm only uncomfortable with it because it's been ignored. It's harder for us to associate this specific group of people who have been ignored than to say children of color. We're all different colors. In reality, white is a color also. Whether you're Asian or Muslim or Native American or black, we have been neglected in this world. Again, 93% of all children's books published only feature Caucasian characters. That means that 7% left for the rest of us. Until there is more balance, until we can kind of crack that statistic and dismantle it, then I'm okay with using that term until we have some equality. And then we can just say children's books. And I think that'll be a beautiful time when we can just go to the books and see this wonderful collage of characters and colors and stories and just allow us to choose. I know we're not there yet, and I don't know what it's going to take for us to get there.
How different would you be as a person today were you to find one of the books that you eventually wrote many years later? How different would your path in connection with money, with finances, with building the type of self-esteem that we all connect to, how different would that have been?
We grew up very poor. My mother had me at 15 years old and my brother at 17. And I was raising these two little boys on her own. And we were on welfare for most of my childhood. So money was not something that was highly talked about because we didn't have a higher degree of it to discuss. I probably learned the importance of entrepreneurship and money from, of all places, George Jefferson on the Jeffersons. Seeing for the first time a Black entrepreneur that I could associate with who also had incredibly great family values and was a pillar of his community, not to mention was extremely charismatic, that was really important for me. So he was really one of my first role models to show me that you can create this world for yourself in your own business and your own economy and money. Because prior to that, as a kid growing up in Eastchester Projects in the Bronx, you didn't have a lot of role models. There weren't abundance of jobs. There wasn't a doctor next door or a lawyer across the street. You didn't have that. You know, there was a drug dealer over here and the wino over there. And those were the people that you associated with. So to see that character really assisted me in developing a sense of entrepreneurship, so much so that almost immediately from seeing that show, I got a newspaper out. I would do odd jobs and wash cars and stuff like that, very much like my character Danny Dollar does, who aspires to be a millionaire when he grows up. What's imperative today, it's an imperative always been, our role model, are that we need to be able to see the people that we can associate with to want to emulate them. You ask the average kid, what do you want to do when you grow up? Well, I want to be a dancer like Misty Copeland. I want to be a basketball player like LeBron James, or I want to be a singer like Beyonce. They always have this level of association. There's someone that they want to aspire to be. And that's wonderful. And that's also another reason why we need more Black, Latino, Hindu, Asian authors, so that our children who have been neglected in this field can be able to say, I want to be an author like Ty Allen Jackson. And when I go and I visit schools, I'm so unbelievably proud. And this is arguably the thing I'm the most proud of, is that usually when I go visit these schools and I talk to these children and I speak to them on their level and I let them know I am them, I get it, especially when I'm going to inner city kids. I am you, 100%. And you can absolutely do this. And when we're done talking and engaging and high-fiving and dancing and just enjoying ourselves, because it's important for me to associate reading with entertainment. You know, I don't want to go in there as stuffy author. I want to go in there as entertainer and doing it through literature. And these kids will take these books and they'll run with them and they'll write me letters and go, I love your book. I want to be a writer too. I want to be an author also. I also want to learn how to illustrate. It's essential for these children to be able to see these characters, fiction and nonfiction. So if we're going to inspire our kids to be financially literate, then we're going to have to showcase the role models, not just the LeBron Jameses and the Beyonces, but the Robert Johnsons of the world and the CEOs who are out there, the Ursula Burns from Xerox. It's important for them to see these role models so that they can inspire to be like them as well.
You were talking about a view of American society where the establishment benefits from the ignorance that the working class has, the absence of access to information, to keep the status quo as is. Clearly, the work that you're doing is a revolutionary in that sense, and it's admirable in model shaping and model shattering. It's an entire system, though. I wonder if enthusiasm, fun, entertainment is enough. How do we change an entire society, particularly now when there is a clear fracture between those that want to protecting the way things are and the dramatic changes that are happening in terms of diversity, in terms of immigration? Writing for children is the place to start, but it's an enormous mountain, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. It is regardless of who you are. I try to empathize so much with the children from today. They really are dealing with things that, from cyberbullying to racial tensions. Growing up as a Black kid in the Bronx, I experienced very little racism in my life. But now my son turns on the TV and he's seeing kids that look like him that don't make it home. It's a terrifying time, especially if you're a child of color, if you're Muslim, if you're worried about being deported. It's a really, really tough time. How we change that and make it better, I think it starts with all of us. For me in particular, it does start with that book. And it does by that level of escapism, by them turning these pages and putting a smile on their face. And I think that's kind of how you change the world. I think we want to sprinkle some magic pixie dust and make it all go away and make this utopia and we all hold hands and sing Kumbaya. But that's not how it's going to happen. There is no short-term solution for these long-term problems. But we start today, and we start today with our children, and we start by loving them and empowering them. And I know in my heart and my soul, with every fiber of my being, that putting a book in their hand is the most important gift that you can give them, other than love, other than you just loving them unconditionally, showing them that the power of reading, it is the greatest barometer for your success. And I think the more that we establish that, the more that we make that into the fabric and culture of our homes and our environment, the better off it is that we're going to be. And again, these are not my opinions. These are statistics proving this. There are cities in this country in which the correction system are figuring out how many jails they need to build based on the literacy rates of fourth graders. Let that sink in. Mind you, they're not trying to figure out how we can make better, more innovative and creative schools so that we proactively eliminate that. That, if anything, needs to be the telltale sign to every single parent, your neighbor, your nephew, your niece, a stranger. I was so honored one day. I met this woman, and I was going into a daycare center, and I gave her a copy of one of my books. It's titled When I Close My Eyes. It's about a little girl who uses her imagination. And she didn't read the book until she got on the train going home. And when she read the book, tears started to come down her cheek. She loved it so much so that she had to give it away. And she looked across the train and she saw a little girl and she gave her the book. And she said the smile that was on that little girl's face was something that she will never, ever forget. We want to outthink things. We want to think that there's these programs and systems and curriculums. It's love and literacy. If we just start with that, we have a foundation of greatness within us.
I want to conclude by asking you about the t-shirt that you're wearing. It's a beautiful t-shirt in red with orange letters that say, read or else. What is it? Where does it come from?
When I was out promoting literacy, my partner and I, his name is Eddie Taylor, really one of the smartest guys I've ever known. We had this program entitled FULL. FULL stands for Families United Through the Love of Literacy. It's actually a program that we implemented in a couple of jails here in Massachusetts to help incarcerated parents connect with their children via literacy, via books. And, you know, we came across these statistics that I mentioned, like 2 out of 3 kids who can't read by the fourth grade end up incarcerated or on welfare. But we also discovered that 70% of all inmates today are functionally illiterate, and that 85% of all teens who go through the judicial system are also functionally illiterate. Also learning that illiteracy is directly connected to teen pregnancy, poverty, high dropout rates, hard drug use, you name it. It is directly connected to illiteracy. So in other words, read or else. So I got this idea and I put it on a t-shirt and I would walk out on town around these t-shirts and people would go, where did you get that? That is absolutely amazing. It didn't take a rock to fall on my head for me to realize, I think I have something here. So we started printing them up. Next thing you know, we sold like a couple hundred in the first month. It's been about a year now, but we wanted also to make a connection. We didn't want it to just be a political statement or a social statement of you need to read. So every single garment, whether it's a t-shirt or a hoodie that says read or else, goes to a child in a designated homeless shelter. Every month we pick a different shelter, and if we sell 50 t-shirts that month, then 50 books go to that shelter. So far, it's been incredibly fulfilling. We have legions of people who are walking billboards about why literacy is so important.
It has been an enormous pleasure and incredibly enlightening to have you here in the show. Thank you so much for coming.
The pleasure is absolutely mine. I really sincerely thank you for having me.
For a society in which success is often measured by material fortune, we are rather secretive about how we talk about money. We feel intruded when this information becomes public, as if an intimate part of us had been inconveniently revealed. Collectively, we're also rather obtuse about how money works. Financial planning isn't taught in the classroom, especially in public schools, and more especially to children of color. Shouldn't this information be part of an open curriculum? How we look at the future in terms of savings, investments, cash flow, and so on? There is a strong argument to be made that this absence keeps the working class in the dark, ignorant, so that it doesn't move out from where it sits in the hierarchy, and that Blacks, Latinos, and other children will go on being marginalized as long as they continue to believe that money, the access one has to it, the accumulation that comes from looking at one's own finances in the long term, doesn't pertain to them directly. It is time to change this attitude. A more just and equal society is what America has strived to be since the beginning. Justice and equality can be achieved in many ways, starting children, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, class, or politics. Talking about money early is essential. One needs to understand money in order to benefit from it. It all starts with literacy in general, the effort of making knowledge available to everyone, including financial literacy. Talking about money should be fun and easy and accessible. It should carry no guilt. It is crucial that minorities feel this is as much in their domain as it is in anyone else's. The road to a better tomorrow, one in which wealth is evenly distributed, not by an artificial power, but by personal incentive, starts there. Next time on In Contrast, why Black Lives Matter matters.
And then they watched Trayvon Martin be killed and Troy Davis be executed. And then Michael Brown's dead on the street. And then Tamir Rice is dead. And it was this reminder that a black president didn't erase the danger that came as an accessory of their black skin.
Wesley Lowry, next time on In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send us an email to radio@npr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook. Our interns include Katie Chen, Antonella Dominguez, Delina Hadgu, and William Harvey. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Fosse. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.